listening to Educating from the Heart. Thank you for joining our lively conversations with teachers, support professionals, parents, and students as they share issues that matter most in our public schools. Here are your hosts, Tina Dunbar and Luke Flint.
Welcome back to another episode of Educating from the Heart, the Florida Education Association podcast that covers all topics related to public schools. I'm Tina Dunbar, along with Luke Flint, my co-host, and he's about to tell us what time it is. So, Luke, what's the one thing that this time of year many educators and students are thinking about?
Well, you know, spring is in the air, so it's pollen season, love bug season. Is that what you mean?
No. Let me give you a hint. Some consider it to be the most intense, pressure-packed, anxiety-ridden time of the school year.
Ah, it's testing season.
Uh-huh, you got it.
You know, it has been almost a year since Governor DeSantis issued an emergency order to extend spring break for 1 week. That extension quickly turned into remote learning for the rest of the school year. And as we approach March of 2021, there are still hundreds of thousands of students who are choosing to learn remotely for their own safety.
And some of our listeners may have heard or read about the growing concerns among parents and teachers over the state's decision to move full speed ahead with statewide standardized assessments. Remember last year, the Florida DOE waived testing? But this spring, students are required to take their assessments in person. State leaders claim the data is needed because they need to know how Florida students are performing. But I'm going to tell you, Luke, that claim just doesn't pass my smell test.
No, nor should it, because we know that schools have been engaged in monitoring of student progress for the entire school year, and we know that they are required to submit that data up to the state. Look, here's the reality. We already know how students are doing, and there would be no new data that we would get from these standardized tests. It seems like continuing with this idea of standardized testing in a pandemic is really more to benefit the testing companies than benefiting students.
But not all testing companies. Recently, the organization that hosts a national test called NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, canceled its spring test. And that might have encouraged the state to add a couple of extra weeks to its testing window. Could that be enough to ease concerns? I don't know, but we have three parents joining us to dive in a little deeper on this issue. Marie Claire Lehman is a Tallahassee parent and an outspoken advocate for Title I public schools. From Miami-Dade, a recently retired teacher who has garnered national attention for her advocacy against misuse of testing data, that's Celeste Smith. And rounding out a group discussion also from Miami is Carla Hernandez-Metz. Carla is an elementary school teacher for students with special needs. She's a parent, and she also serves as the president of the United Teachers of Dade.
Well, that sounds like a really good lineup. Let's jump right in. Carla, what do you think our audience needs to know about high-stakes testing?
Well, first of all, let me say hello to everybody that's listening. I'm glad to be a part of this podcast and, of course, to share as much information as we can possibly do to educate our community on everything that's going on. You know, I think that the pandemic has brought out the best and worst of a lot of people. And we're seeing how some lawmakers are really not interested in helping children at this particular time. You know, testing has always been controversial. Not that teachers are against testing, because, hey, at the end of the day, teachers are the ones that made up tests. We've always done pop quizzes and spelling tests and all kinds of things to assess our children. So we've always been in favor of testing, not to the detriment of students, though, which is what it has become. It has really changed in how we help children, and it's become something that's punitive. And, you know, we know that research has shown how there are test biases and they're biased towards race, towards culture. And, you know, there are all these other factors that also impact, you know, the accurateness of a test and what it measures. But as a parent, I'll tell you this, my children do not test. I opt my children out of testing. I have two elementary age children. I believe that the testing that my teachers do or their teachers do in class, the way that they see them reaching benchmarks, how they grade them on their academic standards, and of course, just their subjects. For me as a parent, that's what I want to see. The person that's working with them directly, how they feel the student is doing, how they're progressing, and that's what I take into account. I am concerned with standardized tests because of the punitiveness that it, you know, that it demonstrates for communities. And when schools don't get funding because of test scores, when teachers are evaluated based on test scores, you know, that's something that brings just red flags and should bring red flags to people. As a special ed teacher, which is what I am a special education teacher. I have seen, you know, another side, right? I have seen how children that have worked really, really hard, have all this anxiety and have worked year round to do well on a test, and their angst, some of them demonstrating it by, you know, throwing up in class right before taking the test, getting migraines, I mean, crying, I mean, all these different side effects that the test pressure brings. And then because they're special ed students and they already have a disability that they're, you know, having to function with, seeing them not meet those standards and still being labeled as failing or being labeled as inadequate, and what that does to their self-esteem, even though I know that those students have progressed and have reached benchmarks, just not the ones that we want to standardize them to because they're not standard children. You know, that really also made me reflect and look at things in a very different way.
And I just want to add also that the idea of testing during this COVID time, it's unworkable. I mean, those who think that it's going to work are not in the classroom and they're not in the homes. There are schools that have more than 50% of their students still learning from home for a reason. Those parents, whether they, whatever their belief might be about testing, they would be taking a big risk to send their kids to school, and they've kept them home now. At that point, they'll have kept them home for 8 months, more than that, right? Since last March, almost a year. And then we're expected to just not worry for those many hours that it takes to test a child. And then on the school front, where we've really tried to be socially distant, we now have to crowd our classrooms to take these tests because not everyone is allowed to proctor them. And so you're going to have these tests done in the old style classrooms. That's the only way to do it in the limited time and to be valid, you know, or whatever. And so not only are parents sending their kids back to an environment that they have not felt comfortable their kids being in, but even the parents who have felt comfortable because they can, you know, see that the school is taking all the measures necessary. Well, those measures are out the window when it comes to testing.
Seresta?
I agree. The testing, it's ridiculous to even engage in that practice at this point. Nothing's consistent right now. Constantly during this pandemic, you've had students removed, teachers removed. They're flipping back and forth between remote learning and in face-to-face learning. Vast majority of students really didn't come back to the school buildings as well. The vast majority of them are on remote. You've had lost students where we can't account for where they are. They're not showing up in either scenario. And I think to take resources and spend it on testing this year, when they could take resources and find the lost students, where they could use their resources wisely to make sure everybody has the correct technology in their homes, the support they need. Home visits, you've got communities. Hillsboro did the home visits. They went looking for the kids. They provided the support. Resources are better used for that as opposed to taking a test that's just going to show basically the same thing it always shows, is that special needs, second language, people of color are going to score worse, far worse than those students that are in middle-class communities that are more stable, et cetera. It's not going to give us any different information.
One of the points that Carla made that I think is a really good one, you know, the legislators say that we have to do the testing this year or else how will we know what the students learn? But what I heard Carla say is my child's teacher knows how my child is doing. Seresta, Marie Claire, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Are the assessments that are actually teacher driven a more informative, more beneficial, more of what students really need right now?
Marie, you want to go first?
Sure. One of the things that is clear in the executive orders of returning back to school is that progress monitoring has to happen and is happening, and it has to be reported to the state on a regular basis. And if you talk to principals, they've worked hard by necessity to align their progress monitoring to the FSA over the years, because it's how they can make sure that their students, for better or worse, right, are going to pass those tests. And so that progress monitoring is telling us as parents — I'm a parent, I'm not a teacher, but it's telling, more importantly, the teachers where their students are at, and it is giving them in real time the information they need to keep helping their students progress. And the information from the testing in any case comes so late, right, that it's not what's going to help the teacher help the student right now in this really limited learning environment that we have.
And really, it doesn't really assess a student's achievement per se. It's limited. You're talking about two subject areas. You're talking about reading and you're talking about math, when there's a whole diverse community of intelligence and subject areas that don't even get looked at, which are just as important and are necessary for students to thrive in the communities in which they live, into the colleges and universities they matriculate into, or training programs. So you're a very narrow focus that has a eugenics history. I mean, where did these tests come from? They came out of eugenics. They came out of Bingham using a standardized assessment to decide — well, they used it for World War I to decide who they're going to throw out on the front line, you know, because their intelligence level was lower, quote unquote, than the others. And they used it to prove in their minds that Northern Europeans were the most intelligent and people of color were the least intelligent. I mean, it's rooted, firmly rooted in racism and false science. And when you look at these tests today, look at all the years that — we'll just look at No Child Left Behind. Look how many years it's been in place. And do you see anything different with the data? Not really.
But I think that's the question that people need to have answered. What is it about this data? If teachers are able to ascertain the information they need in terms of student progress, we're spending millions of dollars on this testing. And kids are emotionally distraught as a result of this testing. What is it that the state gets out of this if it doesn't help teachers and it doesn't help students? And parents need to understand this.
So this is about capitalism, and this is about industries making money. If you want to talk about what it's about, and just like, you know, Mrs. Smith just said, how, you know, this is something that we spend millions of dollars every single year, and the data is not any different. Like, we know what it's going to say. We know that it's going to be about socioeconomics. And so those that have, you know, come from areas where the socioeconomics are much less, you know, are going to, you know, suffer more in terms of academic gaps. So instead of spending millions of dollars on test-taking curriculum and materials, why don't we spend millions of dollars, you know, injecting him into those communities to make sure that we can put the support systems and the resources that are necessary for these children to thrive? This is not new. There have been research studies that are over 30 years old that have been talking about the achievement gap in communities of color, which is directly correlated to poverty levels. And so if we want to, you know, talk about how we really make a change, it's not through taking a test and telling us something that we already know. By the way, we're all different, which is part of the beauty of, you know, mankind. We come with different abilities. Some are academic abilities. Some are emotional intelligence. Some are, you know, just our craftiness, what we can do with our hands, right? And we are trying to predetermine or saying that that all children are widgets and that they're all the same and that they should all reach the same standards and the same potential, which we know is not true. Diane Ravitch just came out with a book last year, Slaying Goliath. And she mentions, you know, Ms. Seresta Smith and the work that she did here in Florida. And she talks about, you know, how this testing, monopoly, I would say, you know, how this testing industry has really deviated, you know, what we do in our education system and how it's really hurting our education system, not helping our education system.
Exactly. And Diane, let me mention that Diane Ravitch was a proponent of all this testing initially. She learned from the mistakes. She saw the evidence that this was worthless. It was useless to throw all these resources into this. She learned, and that's why she's been on this advocacy campaign against standardized testing. She understands the use of NAEP, and I will never argue and say NAEP's not necessary, because I think NAEP serves a purpose. First and foremost is random sampling. You're not holding students accountable by withholding them from moving from third grade to fourth, as in the state of Florida, or requiring it as a assessment that has to be passed prior to achieving a high school diploma, as in Florida, and I think at this point, 9 other states that continue to do this. NAEP does let you know where gains are being made or losses are being made, but it does it for a community. You can see overall in a particular community. And when you look at initially during the Johnson administration, when they started Title I funding, it was to provide resources for communities that were at deficits. And NAEP is an assessment that can help determine some of those deficits. It doesn't punish kids. It doesn't punish educators. It doesn't punish school districts. I mean, the whole concept of using test scores to close down schools, kick whole faculties out of a school, this supposed shutdown, turnaround, hand it over to a private managed charter. I mean, come on now. When I look at just in Miami-Dade County, when I look at when they started bringing testing in a more punitive manner, grading schools, grading teachers. To me, and I'm sure there's other sociological factors involved in this, but when you started stamping kids at an early age as failing, and I would love somebody to do the research on this, it seemed like it escalated a lot of the gun violence that end up occurring in particular communities. Because there's nothing that would make me proud to know I was going to a school that was stamped with an F or a D. Kids are very resilient. My daughter went to graduate programs and did an undergraduate year in the Middle East at American universities that had satellite campuses in the Middle East. And she went to school with a lot of Iraqi students. Now, my daughter's 25 years old, so we're talking about the students that were little kids during the Iraqi wars. Now, they didn't even have schools. When they started bombing inside Iraq and started destroying that whole infrastructure, they had no schools. And so they had gap years, but they were resilient. And the same thing, I think our kids will be resilient as well. But if you're stamping failure on them, in the years they're going through trauma, because let's face facts, this is traumatic what we're going through. This is trauma.
Yes, it is. There's no doubt about that.
No doubt. And if you stamp failure on them while they're going through this
right
trauma, you're escalating the problems.
Right. Do you feel teachers have the resources they need, not just in terms of learning loss, but also the socio-emotional impact of this? the trauma that kids are going through from what may be happening at home?
I think some districts are handling it better than others. And some districts are putting, you know, some resources around these areas. But I can say with certainty that no teacher feels they have the resources they need during this time. I can say that with 100% certainty. The teachers that are in person don't have all the resources that they need. And the teachers that are, you know, teaching in a virtual platform also don't have them. I mean, we still see places where children need devices or they don't have connectivity. And there's that, you know, they live in digital deserts. And, you know, we're seeing all the inequities that exist just through technology. And, you know, I think that one of the things that's extremely important that we've talked about is, being resilient. And I'm sure that Marie Claire, she can talk about how her children are being resilient during this time. I know I've seen it. I've seen teachers be resilient, in how they are adapting to teaching during a pandemic, whether it's in person or virtual. But I've seen my children too, which my children come to work with me every single day because I have them on virtual school. And so I've seen them troubleshoot when technology isn't working. I've seen them help each other, when something is off or one of the students hasn't been able to get on and how they speak up. So-and-so is trying to get on and he or she can't get on. I've seen them just be very empathetic towards each other as well. And those are all, again, things that are not tested. But if you follow the money, we know why certain things happen in education. And it is because people are making money off of our children.
That and even in normal times, right, COVID aside, test results feed a narrative in Florida of privatizing public education. Because if you can demonstrate, as you've both explained so well, that, you know, the school is an F school and therefore why would you want to send your kids there, then you have a captive audience for vouchers. And so the attack, especially on Title I schools, to, you know, be in turnaround and then be closed and then lose staff and then have only staff that stays for teachers that can only handle the pressure for a couple of years. And there's so much more turnaround. And that is all fitting in the narrative of public schools failing students, which we know from the inside is not the case. My kids went to only Title I schools and they're all the elementary, middle and high school are serving the needs of the students very well. But the kids come at a disadvantage from day one, and they're not going to be able to do up, you know, to always make up that difference just in the hours of school time. And so the tests are just so unfair, even at the best of times. And then it was so interesting that you brought up the NAEP, because it's so devious, and I'm a parent and I know I speak kind of harshly, but it's devious to me the way that the FSA is used to show that our schools are failing, but then Florida plays the game by retaining third graders and making sure that on the fourth grade NAEP test, they'll do well because they've had an extra year. And so then the NAEP is used to show that Florida's, you know, accountability system and all that is doing great. And so they want to look good on the national level, but they are willing to make all of our public schools look like they're behind and not doing well to feed the market for privatization.
Exactly.
Yeah, they figured out how to game the system.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. And I just wanted to say that, yes, my kids have been resilient, but, you know, it's easy for them to be resilient too, because we had devices, you know, so I don't know if it took all that much resiliency. I mean, one thing that I will say is that the relationship between students and teachers this year in this time is much more intimate, even for the kids that are online, because, or maybe especially for the kids that are online, where the teachers have to, you know, are forced to take into account the living situation of these students, and that it's great, right? And it's something that you can't measure, and the bonds that are being created and the understanding and the empathy, like you mentioned, Carla. And at the same time, you know, what it also does is that the students are really aware of the stress level of their teachers. they know when their teachers are having a hard time, whether it's with technology or because their administrators are mentioning the FSA a little bit more because they're worried that it's going to come up. And I hear it.
And does that impact their performance?
I'm sure that everyone's on edge. I mean, more than their performance, it's their mood, you know, and their well-being and their eagerness to be involved in participating in the class. I mean, this is such fragile times for everybody. And when the teachers can do what they know is best, they're best placed to help our children, right? The latitude to teach is one of the tools that is most important and that is so easily taken away.
You know, and I think that what Marie Claire mentions and alludes to as well is that, you know, during this time, we should be really trying to engage in social emotional learning. There are so many different variables and situations that students are undergoing. And, you know, again, because it's not something that is on a standardized test, you skip right over it because you know that there's an executive order. You know that you have a commissioner of education that is not supportive to public schools and is going to continue to mandate these things that we know as parents are unnecessary right now. But right now, we should really be focused on social emotional learning and making sure that children are well and that they're happy and that they are surviving this pandemic, because when things are better, when things are under control, we will be able to come back in. We will be able to assess children, make, you know, whatever, do whatever strategies, techniques that we have to implement to try to help mitigate those learning gaps. But we can't do that if the kids aren't there. And right now what they're trying to do is survive. They're surviving a pandemic. All of us are. And, you know, I think that is part of the empathy and the humanity that the Department of Education, who is, you know, right now is being poorly led, is taking us down that path.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Thank you. I think we might be at a good natural break now to focus on the explicit advocacy. I think you all have done a great job of talking about the problems, and I really appreciate naming the racism, naming the capitalism as the problem, because those need to be said. And then for the second half, we want to talk about some of the ways that y'all are fighting back against it.
Yeah, Diane Ravitch's national organization, NPE, as well as a lot of other organizations nationally and within the context of the state and within our unions. We're all doing, of course, the letter writing campaign to all our elected officials to put the test on pause and dump it completely after this year, where those letter writing campaigns are going on. And I still get a bunch of requests from parents to assist with opting out, just writing the letters, submitting the letters to opt out on the individual level. You have a lot of parents. My granddaughter does not take any of these assessments either. She passed from third to fourth grade with a portfolio assessment where they collected her work. She didn't have a problem. I'm sure Carla's doing the same thing with her children. So besides the letter writing, encouraging. Now, Tony mentioned, our vice president for United Teachers Today, mentioned that the federal level is recommending no testing.
Even if the federal level recommends no testing, do you believe that Florida will follow that?
That's the problem. We need a mandate.
Yes, that's the problem. We know that the tests for English language learners has been, the students have been given the option to opt out. And for those who choose to still take the test, they've been given until the end of the year to take it. And this was done by the state. So the commissioner can make an adjustment.
Right. And to answer the first part of your question, it's because of advocacy. If it was up to the state, there would be no waivers on any of those things. They were trying to have students that are English speakers of other languages, ELL students, come into the school sites and all take the test. Because of advocacy workers from, you know, LULAC, LACLA, different, you know, organizations that care about how children are being measured. There was also a letter writing campaign trying to bring or shed light to this situation so that, you know, the Department of Education could take different steps. And they did. So I think that that also answers your question, which is we have to be advocates. We have to be loud. We have to get involved. You know, we have to share information with friends, because if we do it, if we mobilize, if we are organized, then we can create the changes that we need. And a lot of those changes are obviously, I'm going to go back on my soapbox, is, you know, we need a vote. We need a vote for people who care about public education and care about strengthening, you know, how our children are educated.
That's true. Do you feel enough parents understand or know about the portfolio choice?
Yeah, no, you're right that more parents need to know. I think it's a pretty difficult environment still between parents and teachers at that, you know, at the third grade level in terms of advocating for your child to have a portfolio. When I found it difficult as a parent, because I knew the other ramifications of the test. So my kids went to an elementary school that for many of the years that they were at the elementary school was a D school. And I wanted my kids to opt out, but I knew my kids would do well on the test. So it was a real conundrum, because I didn't want my school to stay a D school. And there was, you know, their grade could help a little bit, right?
Those scores were very important. Yeah.
Right. And so, and the teachers knew it, and they knew where I stood, and they, you know, had a lot of respect for me as a parent and as an advocate. But for parents to be pitted against teachers in that way, unless the portfolio is something that the teacher can truly advocate for, right, on behalf of the family, like they need to, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that you can pit the parent against the teacher when the child is in third grade and you're struggling so hard as a teacher to be a partner to that parent, and vice versa, at a really crucial time in a child's education. And I feel like the passing of that knowledge, if it's stigmatized in any way, really hurts that relationship one way or the other, right? And people have to tiptoe around it. And I don't think that parents understand that enough, definitely not. And I don't think that parents, honestly, I don't think parents understand enough how limited that school grade is. And so I've had conversations with parents that say, hey, you know, like, why would I send my kid to a D school? And I want to say, well, did you visit it? Because what you see at the school is not reflected in the school grade. That is your, especially in elementary school, your, you know, your math and your ELA for only three grade levels. There's so much more that goes into it. And when parents don't understand that and make decisions based on such a limited measure, it really hurts entire communities.
Yeah. So we've talked, you know, quite a bit about advocacy in terms of what parents, how parents can advocate, how teachers can advocate. I'm wondering, at the upper grade levels, what role, if any, does a high school student have in advocating for the best testing conditions, the best learning conditions, I should say, for themselves, instead of just being a test taker, actually being a student? Any thoughts on that?
Various different states. I have seen a lot of student advocacy and a lot of student resistance. I can think of two in particular, in California and in Michigan. Florida, I don't think students, the best advocacy and activism that I've seen out of Florida students happened with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. It took a tragedy to really get students to organize and see and understand the power that they have. So in Florida, so many parents, and this has been a handicap, so many parents buy into the lie that these tests are necessary. I want my kid to take that test. I want to see if the teacher's teaching him anything, which is not a reflection of what the teacher, it honestly isn't, you know. There's a disconnect, I think, when it comes to students understanding that they don't have to sit for it, particularly the older ones, don't have to sit for assessment if they don't so desire.
Well, it seems like this might be the perfect time for a reset of some sort, a time to reform our accountability system to something that really does work for students and teachers and parents also, you know. What would that look like if you went to a legislator and said, hey, we need to change this. This is a perfect time. This is what you need to do. Marie Claire, what would you like to see happen?
Well, I think you're right that it's the perfect time because, and I know I'm not answering your question exactly, but it's the perfect time because you can bring people a little bit closer at this time. And I think we can, you know, other people are taking advantage of the pandemic in other ways that are frustrating and feel undemocratic and unfair. And I think that we should be taking advantage of the pandemic. You know, I say that, you know, a little bit jokingly, but because it is highlighting the injustice of the test, the unfairness of the test, the unnecessary nature of the test. And the lost learning, everything like that is being highlighted. And so it's very interesting because when you have conversations with, you know, people, just district officials or administrators at schools, teachers, neighbors, whatever, a lot of people, you know, you're either like, yeah, there shouldn't be high stakes. And then others are a little bit further along where they're like, there shouldn't be a test at all. And then others are a little bit further along and like us here and say, there should never be a test, you know, with this kind of test and this kind of high stakes attached to it, even in normal times. And so it's like giving us the opportunity to have the conversation in the first place, meet people where they're at and move them along. Because if you are willing to say that it's unnecessary this year, then you're pretty close to being able to understand that it's unnecessary in normal times, right?
So I want to take a stab at this too. So a few things. I think that the timing is perfect right now because everyone in the entire planet is reevaluating how they do things just in general. How we shop, how we do work, how we communicate, how we educate. And so I think that even the way we see, you know, traditional education, there's going to be a lot of innovation in all industries. And there has to be innovation in education as well. If I was asking a legislator for something in particular, I would say that we rethink, you know, what our education system, how we do it, right? How we innovate in this, you know, all the things that we've learned through the pandemic. And so, you know, how do we think of all these innovative things that we could do? And I would also say that we ask legislators to give public tax dollars to public schools that are governed by school boards that are elected. We have so much money that is going into private industry. We have so much of our public tax dollars that is going to make these private property owners money on our backs.
So I think one of the things that really needs to be done is working very hard to get a change up there in Tallahassee. We've been under this oppression for, what is it, almost 18, 19 years now? And we see each year how the dollars are taken more and more away from, and we see the negative impact. So I think that's one area.
I just wanted to add too that I think that all of our advocacy, and Carla mentioned it earlier, we always have to draw a link to voting. You know, every time we're bringing this up, we need to remind people that we're in this situation because of not turning out the vote and not helping people have access to the vote. And it's very important to connect the two. and to connect parents with parents. Because Tina, your point is well taken. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that I started throwing myself into sort of beyond opt out, I guess, or in addition or whatever, was to organize our Title I community in Tallahassee into a Title I advisory council of parents predominantly and teachers representatively and administrators as well on a representative basis, so that those needs of Title I schools could have a voice, and rather than just have parents pick up and leave their Title I school communities. And I think that, you know, so much work can be done through from parent to parent and through those channels and organizing our communities and being supportive of our schools in all of the ways that we can be as parents without, you know, we have no strings attached, right? We have no our job, we're not teachers. Our jobs are not on the line when we advocate for our schools.
Wow, what a powerful conversation. It really seems like what happens next is up to us, to all of us.
That is so true, but I want to be clear that our guests are not directing parents to opt out. Instead, we all want to make sure that parents recognize opt out is another choice option. Also, Florida lawmakers have filed a bill that, if passed, would shield students, educators, and schools from the punitive consequences of this year's testing. We'll see if legislators follow the DOE or respond to parent concerns. But we know some parents, similar to our guests, have already made the decision to choose safety over testing.
Yeah, we'll have to see if this trend catches on. You know, will this be the year that parents and students rise up and push back against standardized tests and the high-stakes consequences associated with them? You know, I'm not a parent, but if I did have a school-aged child, I'd think long and hard before having them sit for their test, especially during a pandemic.
And I'm so glad my kids are out of school, so I don't have to make that decision. Well, that's it for our show, and I want to thank you for listening. Don't forget, you can find out more information about all of the topics we talk about in our episode by visiting the show notes page on our website, feaweb.org/podcast.
We appreciate your feedback, comments, and suggestions. Please keep sending them in by emailing heart@floridaea.org. That email address again is heart@floridaea.org. Or you can call and leave a voicemail at 850-201-3384. That's 850-201-3384. Hope to hear from you.
Until we meet again, keep educating from the heart.
Hi, this is FEA President Andrew Sparr. To stay on top of all the latest news and issues impacting our public schools, be sure to follow FEA on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For more information on this podcast, visit feaweb.org/podcast.
FEA is the statewide educators union with more than 150,000 members, including teachers, education staff professionals, higher education faculty, graduate assistants, students preparing to become teachers, and retired educators. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent policy or position of the FEA.